Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This morning, the Senate voted 51-49 to send Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the full Senate. And we have just learned that Republican Senator Jeff Flake said that unless, quote, something big happens, he will vote to confirm Kavanaugh. Susan Collins is expected to make an announcement at noon Pacific time, and we will discuss the latest in about 40 minutes. But first, we're going to talk about Afghanistan. This Sunday marks the 17-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, more than 10,000 Afghan civilians were killed or injured in 2017, and that number is expected to be even higher this year. The Afghan war is costing U.S. taxpayers $45 billion a year, yet this is something that is rarely debated in this country. Joining us to discuss media coverage are two guests. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul. He writes for various outlets about what is happening on the ground. Hi, Ali. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us, Ali. We're also joined by Anand Gopal, an award-winning freelance journalist and author of the book No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Hi, Anand. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you both so much for joining us. Well, as with so many important issues, they're being overshadowed by what's happening in the United States. Ali, we've had you on many times to talk about what's happening on the ground in Kabul and Afghanistan. And I'm sure a lot of people don't know that more than 10,000 civilians were killed last year, and that number is expected to be even higher this year. First off, why are these numbers so high?
The numbers are so high because, I mean, it's 10,000 killed and injured, but the numbers are so high for a number of a variety of reasons. One is that these groups, including the Taliban and Daesh, are increasingly targeting urban centers, so like Kabul and the city of Jalalabad. Also, you know, we have to remember that there are also civilian deaths being caused by airstrikes, both foreign and Afghan. And really, the war is just intensifying in the sense that these opposition groups really want to show their powers by targeting these, you know, very populated urban centers. And that's really what's leading to the high civilian casualty toll.
And Anand, what would you add?
Yeah, and on top of that, there's been an escalation of the conflict from the American side in the last year and a half. The intensity and the pace of airstrikes has increased greatly, particularly in rural areas like Helmand, Kandahar. And most of this is unreported, and there's incidents that I hear about from friends in those areas of airstrikes that killed or injured large numbers of people that tend not to make it into the media.
Can you elaborate on that, Anand? I mean, the AP reports that the Afghan war is costing taxpayers $45 billion a year. What exactly is the American presence in Afghanistan like today?
There are some troops on the ground, including special forces and including troops that are partnered with the Afghan forces, the Afghan army. But I think more important than that presence is the fact that the U.S. essentially props up the Afghan state by paying for, you know, for the salaries of many of its employees, for paying for the Afghan army. And in fact, if the U.S. and the other rest of the international countries stopped paying for the Afghan state, it would probably just collapse overnight. And so what the U.S. has done essentially is create a very unsustainable situation in the country where it almost requires a continued American presence to prop up the state.
What would be the alternatives?
Oh, the alternative would be pushing for a negotiated settlement between the Taliban and the Afghan government. And, you know, that would require actually a lot of sort of political will from the United States to do so, which they haven't really demonstrated. Neither Trump nor Obama have really demonstrated a real desire to try to end the conflict. They've kind of adjusted things at the margins, throwing a little bit more troops at it or taking some troops out. But the fundamental dynamic of the war, which is that you have a large and very powerful Taliban movement, and that has a bit of a rural constituency in some parts of the country, against a Afghan government that's supported by the United States. It also has a constituency, and essentially it's like a civil war, which is being, you know, the U.S. has basically determined the political cost of continuing to fight this war is lower than trying to push for a settlement.
Ali, you are in Kabul, so you experience what happens, obviously, on the ground on a regular basis. You're living there. Tell us about the Afghan government.
It's what Anand was saying, in that sense that it is a propped up government. And the problem with the government is that because, for instance, this government is a national unity government, where the number one and the number two place candidates were made to create this unity government where they both have positions in this government. And what's happening is that you're having more and more defections from this government. So people who were literally in the government yesterday are now criticizing the government and accusing it of all sorts of crimes and ethnic bias and prejudice and things like that. You even have people who are sitting currently in the government, like the first vice president who came back from Turkey after a year, who is part of a coalition that is essentially trying to campaign against the government that he's in right now. And the other issue that you have with the government is that their services don't really extend out to much of the country. So one of the excuses that they usually give is that, okay, there's instability in certain areas, but then you also have provinces where there is relative peace and stability, where they aren't getting basic things, you know, healthcare, electricity, proper roads. For instance, one of my aunts recently went to the north, and she was saying, so the Solang Pass, which leads to the north, we were on it a couple of years ago, and she's saying, like, the situation on that road, the road is completely deteriorated in that amount of time. So people don't really have faith in the government because they're not seeing them providing them the kinds of things that the government should be, and at the same time, there's internal fights within the government.
What else can you tell us, Ali, about what life is like for everyday Afghans? I mean, you talked about electricity. What else do we need to know in terms of, like, clean water, basic infrastructure? What does that look like?
It's not there. Even within Kabul, you know, you go just a little bit outside of the city center and you will go to areas where there are still dirt roads that are unpaved. You know, the winter is about to come, so people will be without electricity for hours. Clean water is not easily accessible. Education, you know, there's something like 3 million children that are out of the education system right now. Some of that is due to insecurity, for sure. And the other part of that is just basically the lack of investment and development of that sector. So again, this really comes back to this issue of how can you have faith in a government that's not providing you with these sorts of basic things.
That is Ali Latifi. He's a freelance journalist based in Kabul. And Anand Gopal is an award-winning freelance journalist and author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand, you wrote a very important book about the history of Afghanistan, about military invasions by the Russians, by the United States and its allies. You know, here we are 17 years later. The United States, under the Bush administration, claimed that it was invading Afghanistan to defeat the Taliban and find Osama bin Laden, right? We heard this over and over again after 9/11. Give us a sense of, talk about the invasion and the effect that that had on Afghanistan. And, you know, thinking about the fact that 10,000 civilians were either killed or injured just last year, and this year it's expected to be higher.
Well, you know, what's remarkable about all of this is that the United States invaded in 2001 and more or less won the war. They defeated the Taliban very quickly. The Taliban was not a popular force. It was not a popular government, and they were able to overthrow that government fairly easily in the course of 2 months. And at that point, the Taliban as a movement basically disbanded and went back home. What the U.S. did was they deployed special forces and the CIA to the ground with a counterterrorism mission to basically find bad guys and arrest or kill bad guys. But yet there were no actual terrorists left. Al-Qaeda had fled the country. The Taliban had basically quit and surrendered. And so what the U.S. did is they started to spend a lot of money propping up warlords, creating new warlords, and sort of empowering them to find these bad guys, and what these warlords did essentially is turn over their own rivals, you know, and accuse people falsely of being Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And so lots of innocent people were tortured, were imprisoned, were sent to Guantanamo, were killed by the U.S. and by U.S. Proxies, U.S. warlords. And by doing this, it's actually helped to reconstitute the Taliban as an insurgent movement. And what's really tragic about that is that process basically was crystallized by 2004. And since then, we've essentially been fighting the same conflict since 2004. So you just think about the sheer number of people who have needlessly died in the last 14 years without any end in sight.
Do we know, Anand, how many people have died? Go ahead, Ali.
I just wanted to add on to that, what happened in the last 17 years. So we have the issue that Anand brought up in terms of the warlords and the civilian casualties and people being sent to Guantanamo and Bagram and things like that. You also have massive inequities that have developed, right? So the way I put it is it's basically increasing
Ali,
the divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Ali, sorry,
can
you move to maybe a different part of the room? Your line all of a sudden just got bad.
Sure.
Okay, that sounds better.
Sure.
Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So what I was saying is that it's created massive divides among the people in terms of economic divides. So you're having a society where this disparity between the haves and the have-nots, as I put it, has completely skyrocketed. So you have people, you know, these warlords and their proxies and their supporters and the NGO economy and the media economy, politicians who are making millions and millions and millions of dollars, investing a lot of that money outside of the country. While in the country right now, we have something like a 45% unemployment rate, and you have people, like I said, in Kabul, living in dirt roads, going to school in tents, and really not seeing any of that development reach them. So this has also created a massive problem for the government. It's sort of like a heightened version of what happened under the kingdom, but in this case, it's so much more visible. And again, that creates a huge issue for the government and amongst the people, because you're really seeing people in armored cars and with guards and all of these things running around town while the average person is just literally trying to survive.
Wow. Ali, we're going to call you back and hopefully get a better connection. That's Ali Latifi. He is a freelance journalist based in Kabul, Afghanistan. We're also joined by Anand Gopal, an award-winning freelance journalist and author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. And then later in the show, we'll be talking about Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Senate. Anand, what about the points that Ali just made, that there's such a divide now between what he called the haves and the have-nots? There's so much poverty in Afghanistan, and you know, a lot of the money is going to, you know, government officials and corrupt officials. Can you talk about that and how that plays out?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, what's astonishing about that is just if you look at the sheer amount of money that's been poured into the country, billions and billions of dollars that the United States primarily and the rest of the international community has poured into Afghanistan. And in fact, that money has actually worked to impoverish most Afghans, because that's gone to corporations, American private military contractors. It's gone to Afghan warlords. It's gone to creating a sort of nouveau riche among the Afghan elite that now keep houses in Dubai and keep have bank accounts with millions and millions of dollars, while their fellow countrymen are starving or have no basic services, and I think it also is something that's fed into the conflict, because you have this sense that there's a small group of people who've enriched themselves extraordinarily. Those are Americans and Afghans, by the way, who've enriched themselves extraordinarily at the expense of the majority of Afghans. And certainly that's a message that the Taliban, in the communities where it's strong, certainly sort of tried to promote, saying that they are the ones who are protecting against this sort of venality, this sort of corruption.
And Anand, can you tell us who's making these decisions when it comes to doling out this money? I mean, what are the biggest differences between how that worked under Obama and how it's working under Trump?
I mean, there really aren't that many differences, honestly. You know, there's a question of scale. You know, sometimes different administrations have ratcheted up the amount of money or brought it back down, but the very dynamic, this fundamental logic of how money is spent has been mostly the same between Bush, Obama, and Trump, which is that most of the money is spent on military, not on, on humanitarian efforts. Mm. Most of the money is spent in sort of cascades of subcontracting. So, you know, you want to go build a road somewhere in Afghanistan. You don't give that money directly to Afghans to build the road. You subcontract it to American corporations, usually, who then subcontract it out and so on down the chain until eventually it gets to some small company in Afghanistan and there's no oversight over what they do with that money. That model of spending money has been basically in place since 2001, and there's been really no change from any administration on it.
Well, if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about Afghanistan, it has been 17 years since the United States invaded that country. Just last year, more than 10,000 Afghan civilians were either killed or injured. That number is expected to be even higher this year. The AP recently had a fairly short piece about how the Afghan war is costing the United States taxpayers $45 billion a year. And Anand Gopal says most of that money is spent on military contractors. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Anand Gopal is author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, 104,000 people have been killed in Afghanistan since 2001. 31,000 have been civilians. An additional 41,000 civilians have been injured since 2001. Ali, do those numbers sound about right to you and what the research you've done?
The problem with those numbers is that they may be correct, but one of the problems, and I think Anand can attest to this, is that we have an issue here where, for instance, you know, the government every day posts updates saying, like, for instance, we killed this many militants, we killed this many Daesh, we killed this many Taliban. And the truth is, because the areas they're in, because of when they take place, it's very difficult to actually assess those situations and find out who was killed. So in terms of civilian casualties, that number, and you know, the government always denies or stays quiet about civilian casualties. So there were several airstrikes in the north and the east of the country in the last month or so that the UN documented and didn't resulted in civilian casualties, and those things never get addressed. So this is a major issue where we're constantly being told, you know, this many Taliban or Daesh or militants or whatever were killed, but there's really no way to prove that. And when you go to many of these provinces, as I've been, you know, they say the issue is, for instance, like if I were meeting with people, you know, who the government might commit and classify enemy combatants, and you know, I was government killed in that attack, they would likely count me as an enemy combatant too. So this is precisely the issue, that we don't have real numbers and we're just constantly being told X number of fighters or whatever were killed.
And Anand, so Human Rights Watch found, as Ali just said, that the Afghan government has no capacity to investigate civilian casualties. And according to reports, U.S. forces downsize civilian casualties. So what would you add? I mean, how do we know what the real numbers are?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ali that it's very hard to say what the numbers are. You know, I've done studies on civilian casualty estimates in other countries, and even in places that are much more developed, it's very hard to do. And in Afghanistan, where large parts of the countryside, for the reasons Ali mentioned, are really underdeveloped or impoverished, it's very hard to get there. The Taliban are not friendly to journalists and not friendly to independent researchers. The Afghan government certainly isn't that friendly either to those entities. It makes it very difficult. I mean, whether it's 100,000 or 200,000, I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. But what we can say is that a large number of people have been killed and injured, and it's probably far greater than most Americans could even begin to realize.
Mm. What about drone strikes? Over the years, there have been good coverage of drone strikes. Human Rights Watch, between November 2017 and April of this year, interviewed 42 civilian airstrike victims and witnesses. Anand, what can you tell us about drone strikes? How often do they happen, and who's carrying them out?
Well, I mean, yeah, drone strikes happen, but I think what's important to point out is a lot of the bombing is just old-fashioned, you know, piloted aircraft. And, you know, where you see drone strikes or drones making up the majority of the strikes is places like Pakistan, where the U.S. legally is not able to fly sort of manned aircraft. But in Afghanistan, it's in some respects, it's very old-fashioned in the sense that they're just using, there's all sorts of planes in the air with pilots. And from the point of view of those who are on the receiving end, of course, it doesn't really make a difference whether they're remotely controlled or piloted. The point is, either way, there's a lot of airstrikes and a lot of civilian casualties. But anyway, the drone strikes mostly would be carried out by the United States.
Ali, what would you add?
That's exactly. So we're going back to the earlier problem that I was talking about, because I have went to see people who have been, whose families have been victims to drone strikes, and this is exactly the same issue that I brought up earlier, where I would go to them and I would say, okay, did the government come? Did rights groups come? Civil society activists, journalists, the media, and they would say no, because there's very little follow through on these things. And when you do try and report on them,
Ali, I'm sorry, we're having a hard time again with your connection. We'll try to get a clearer connection. We're connecting with Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist based in Kabul, Afghanistan. We think it's really important to talk to a journalist who's actually in Afghanistan, but sometimes that means that we have a line that's unpredictable. So hopefully, we'll try to get a better line for Ali. Anand, let's talk about what it means to be a journalist in Afghanistan, and hopefully we can reconnect with Ali with a better number. 13 journalists have been killed in Afghanistan just this year. So what is it like for you when you report in Afghanistan? Are you able to move freely, or what is that like?
I'm mostly able to move freely, but Afghanistan is one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be a journalist, but less so for me as an American. Honestly, it's much more dangerous for Afghan journalists, and I think the majority of those who've been killed or wounded were Afghans. That's where the real danger is, and I think it's in part because Afghan journalists don't have the infrastructural protections that a foreign correspondent like me might have. Mm. You know, it's interesting because some news bureaus have a lot of security protocols in place. Sometimes those protocols differ if you're a local national or if you're a foreigner. In many cases, the insurgents are less likely to kill a foreign journalist because they see them as a source of potential ransom, whereas for obvious reasons, they won't see that for a local journalist. So for all these reasons, I think it's local journalists, Afghan journalists, who are really the ones who are under most threat.
And Ali, are you back with us?
Yes.
Okay, hopefully we have a better line. Sorry about that, Ali. We were just talking about the difficulty and the danger involved in being a journalist on the ground in Afghanistan. What has your experience been like?
So the difficulties come in several forms, right? So on the one hand, you do have an increase in the Taliban and the so-called Daesh forces targeting journalists to the point where they will basically wait for journalists and first responders to come to the scene, and then they stage another attack. But you also have the issue of journalists being killed basically mysteriously, and you don't know who's carrying that out. You don't know if that's someone who lied with the government. You don't know if that is these armed opposition forces. And these things never get investigated, as Anand was saying earlier.
And Reuters is reporting that Afghan media are facing growing pressure to cut back coverage of militant attacks following the death of two TV reporters who were among 20 killed in an attack on a sports club in Kabul last week. Samin Faramaz, a reporter for Tolo News, and cameraman Ramiz Ahmadi were killed by a car bomb, apparently targeting first responders and journalists, as they were covering a suicide attack at a wrestling club in Kabul. I read about this wrestling club in the New York Times, and it was just such an awful story. People going to wrestle, and it apparently was a beautiful club, and a suicide bomber came in and just completely killed so many people, and the club is now in shambles.
The difficulties come in several forms, right? So on the one hand, you do have an increase in the Taliban and the so-called Daesh forces targeting journalists, mm-hmm. To the point where they will basically wait for journalists and first responders to come to the scene, and then they stage another attack. But you also have the issue of journalists being killed basically mysteriously, and you don't know who's carrying that out. You don't know if that's someone aligned with the government. You don't know if that is these armed opposition forces. And these things never get investigated, as Anand was saying earlier.
Wow. Well, this happened last month, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul, Afghanistan. I'm sorry about his line, but sometimes this happens when we call overseas. Anand Gopal is an award-winning freelance journalist and author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. On today's Media Roundtable, we are marking the 17-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. The war is costing taxpayers in the U.S. $45 billion a year, most of that spent on the military. According to the U.N., 10,000 Afghan civilians were killed or injured last year. That number is expected to be even higher this year. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you become involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A. Stay with us here on KLW if you can.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are marking the 17-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. We're speaking with Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist based in Kabul, and Anand Gopal, an award-winning freelance journalist and author of the book No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. We have an email from Eileen who says, I was reading in the paper just yesterday that Blackwater was lobbying to take over the training of the Afghan military. Would taxpayers be paying for that? And the Washington Post has a piece about how Eric Prince is pushing for the privatization of the Afghan war. I'll just read the lead. More than a year after his plan to privatize the Afghan war was first shot down by the Trump administration, Eric Prince returned late last month to Kabul to push the proposal on the government in Afghanistan, where many believe he has the ear and the political backing of the U.S. president. Anand, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is an idea that's come up recurrently over the years, and recently I think there was a statement from the presidency, the Afghan presidency, essentially saying that they reject the idea of privatizing the war. Although it should be said that the Afghan war has been privatized from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that makes it very unique and marks it as distinct from some of the other conflicts, which is that what we've had from 2001 onwards is private security companies and private militias, mostly Afghan-led militias, being paid for by the United States as among the principal actors in the conflict. What Eric Prince wants to do is basically get in on that and have his company sort of take over the leading role in all of that. The statement from the president's office basically said this is like giving up, sort of, they're not going to give their national security over to somebody who wants to make a profit, essentially.
And Ali, what would you add? Oh, we lost him. Okay. So, Anand, what is the end game here? I mean, 17 years, $45 billion a year, hardly ever debated. I mean, some politicians try to talk about this. Very, very few, though, out of the many that are in Washington. What is the end game for the United States here?
Well, that's exactly it. There is no end game. I think what the U.S. has demonstrated is both administrations have demonstrated they're actually comfortable basically continuing this conflict in perpetuity. There's almost no, as you said, there's almost no debate around this. There's no voices either in the public at large or in Washington that are pushing back against this. And yeah, $45 billion sounds like a lot, but you know, the U.S. Congress just voted a few months ago to increase the defense appropriations again.
Right.
So it's never been controversial to spend money on war. It's controversial in our country to spend money on health care and other things, but not to spend money on war. And so $45 billion a year basically can go on in perpetuity. Most Americans probably don't even know or have a clear sense that we're still at war in Afghanistan. Mm. Most of us are completely inured from the effects of being at war. The number of people who go and fight are such a tiny proportion of the population. They mostly come from particular parts of the country that I say this with great fear, but I think it's possible for the United States to essentially just continue this.
Well, and I want to make sure I have my facts right, but this last military spending bill, you had Bernie Sanders voting no. Cory Booker voted for it, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, and I'll make sure we have that right. But what about that? I mean, hardly any debate, even on the Democratic side, about massive, massive military spending bills. And according to reports, this F-35 program, which is a Lockheed Martin program, so incredibly wasteful, is expected to cost the Pentagon about $406 billion for 2,456 fighter jets.
Well, look, what we've seen, especially since 2001, is all of this has been a bipartisan project. There's been really no pushback from mainstream Democrats, because you have Bernie Sanders and those types who are raising voices against this. But for the most part, this has been, I mean, for 8 years, this was President Obama's policy.
Right.
There was no question. There was no questioning on the fundamental premises of war. It doesn't make sense to spend this kind of money, especially in a war that's killing tens of thousands of people and bringing no resolution.
Let's hear from, do we have a caller? Let's go to Ariane.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Just, I think the question would be, why would the government of this country want to fight war in perpetuity? And I think the answers are all around us. They're trying to destabilize the world political stage. It's not just about creating enhanced power among the people who have it already and protecting the status quo. There are actually people in our government and our corporations who are willing to destroy the entire planet, and they're being used. They use warlords, they use people all over, and we have to really look at, in the mirror for that. I'd like to hear your guest's thoughts and opinions about perspectives about why he thinks the U.S. engages in perpetual war.
All right, thank you. Anand?
I actually couldn't hear the question, if you could repeat it.
Well, the simple way to put it is, why does the U.S. engage in perpetual war?
Yeah, it's a really good question, I think, for a number of reasons. One is that war is good business. And secondly, I think war and the prospect of enemies at the gates is something that's very useful in politics. It's useful to keep Americans afraid. And then thirdly, I think the U.S. has geostrategic interests, or U.S. leaders believe they have geostrategic interests in certain parts of the world, particularly the Middle East, for resources, oil, for making places safe for American businesses, for a lot of different reasons. But what's, you know, that's always been the case, I think, but what's unique about this sort of post 9/11 era is that now war is the normal state of being, and peace is the exception. And so, you know, it's just accepted by everybody that we're just going to be at war.
Mm. The military spending is higher than at any time than the height of the Iraq War, adjusted for inflation. Thank you for that call, Ariane, and we'll do a show about that because we talk about military spending pretty regularly on this show. Anand Gopal is an award-winning freelance journalist and author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And unfortunately, we did lose Ali Latifi, but I want to thank Ali. He does put his life on the line to give people on the ground a voice and to report for various outlets in this country. So I hope you can check out his work, and hopefully we can connect with him in the future. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist based in Kabul. Unfortunately, we lost his connection. Well, now we are going to switch gears and talk about the latest on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the full Senate. And joining us now is Will Bunch, an award-winning journalist, national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and author of the political blog Attitude. Oh, okay, sorry, we just lost Will Bunch. I'm wondering if we got any breaking news just in the last 40 minutes, but here's what's happening. This morning, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski voted against sending Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the full Senate. And a number of reporters say that if she voted no this morning, that probably means she's going to vote no again. Senator Jeff Flake just announced about a half hour ago that unless something big happens, he will vote to confirm Kavanaugh, and we're expecting an announcement from Susan Collins at noon Pacific. And joining us now is Will Bunch. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. Did anything break in the last 40 minutes that we need to know about?
Not that I'm aware of. I've been monitoring it somewhat closely, but I think you described the day's two biggest developments so far, which is the no vote from Lisa Murkowski, which apparently, and this is very interesting, apparently was kind of spontaneous. I mean, she really was undecided or wavering until she actually got onto the Senate floor this morning and voted no on the cloture vote, but also will vote no tomorrow. So that basically means that two of the other three wavering votes would also have to vote no. As you mentioned, it looks pretty much like Jeff Flake from Arizona, who's one of those three, is a yes vote. And so I think really, I think everyone agrees at this point that probably whatever Susan Collins does at 3 o'clock this afternoon, Eastern time, noon your time out in the Pacific, is going to, you know, really kind of be the decider, because I think Joe Manchin's in such a tough spot that he's going to, I think he would like to vote for Kavanaugh. I think he doesn't want to be the deciding vote, though. So if Susan Collins joins Flake in supporting him, he wouldn't be the deciding vote anyway. So I think the whole ball game is going to be what happens later today with Susan Collins.
Hmm. Well, and you know, so much of this, Will, you could say, as a result of thousands and thousands of women and men flocking to Washington, D.C. from across the country, including Alaska. You wrote about some of the women who talked, you know, basically told Jeff Flake, do the right thing in the elevator. I mean, sharing their sexual assault stories for the first time on national television. Can you talk about how that has been covered? I mean, even as we speak, there are activists in the Senate and the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I mean, to be honest, I kind of wish there was almost more coverage. I mean, I thought yesterday afternoon you had this incredibly powerful moment when protesters who were mostly but not exclusively women flooded the, I believe it was the Hart Senate office building, one of the main office buildings in the Capitol complex, and basically shut it down because there were so many of them. They just flooded the entire building, and finally, I believe the police arrested about 300 of them, including a couple of celebrities like Amy Schumer, comedian, actress. But I was surprised there was not more coverage of that, because I think you're absolutely right. I think people raising their voices, protesters. I mean, let's not forget. I mean, this whole thing started with a woman's decision to speak out. You know, and that's Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. If had she not decided to raise her voice, we wouldn't be here at this point. But then so many others, and you know, the two women, Maria Gallagher and Anna Maria Chirilla, who spoke out in the elevator, the Jeff Flake. I mean, you could see Jeff Flake's face in the committee room after that, and you could tell that encounter had an influence on him. And like you said, I'm pretty sure Lisa Murkowski's dramatic decision today was usually influenced by the fact that she spent a lot of time yesterday meeting with survivors of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. You know, that apparently she had very long meetings with these people who'd come from Alaska to tell their stories, and she was very moved by them. And I think that's probably what influenced her vote in the end. So that's been a huge part of this story, and I think it can't be highlighted enough, because you know that's been a bigger issue in the whole Trump era. You know, can I make a difference? You know, if I speak out, if I protest, or if I, you know, write an op-ed, or if I do anything, you know, is it going to make a difference? And you know, we're seeing specific instances where in this Kavanaugh confirmation fight where you can look at it and you can say, yes, absolutely, it's making a difference.
And I believe it was Anna Maria Archila who said that her father, she sent a text to her father saying, you're going to find out about this on national news, but don't worry, I'm okay.
I think both of them, you know, they were in this bizarre position where they basically told Senator Jeff Flake about their sexual assault before they told their own family members.
I mean, it's just, it's really amazing. But, you know, Will, we've been doing shows. Last week, we took breaks during the hearings, and then yesterday we opened the lines, and we heard from woman after woman. One man called last week, right, sharing their stories for the first time ever.
Right.
So how do you
I was just
going to ask you, how do you think the media are, you know, reporting on this and then being sensitive enough not to play Trump mocking Blasey Ford on a loop over and over again?
Well, sensitivity isn't really the media's strong point, especially when politics takes over. I think that tape that you just mentioned of Trump and also the large crowd behind Trump who was cheering, when he mocked a sexual assault survivor, I mean, I just thought that was a special low point in American history. But, I think on the whole, you know, I'm both a critic of the media and a defender of the media, and I'm a member of the media. And on when it comes to the Me Too movement, I think on the whole, the media has been more positive. I mean, I think you have to acknowledge that the Me Too movement might not have started the way it did had it not been for the work of reporters like the New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story, and certainly Ronan Farrow, and more recently working with Jane Mayer, I forget about her, but many of these instances have come to light. In the Kavanaugh instance, journalists have played a key role. You know, both the Washington Post journalists who, you know, work with Dr. Blasey Ford to get her story out, and then more recently the New Yorker telling the story of the second accuser at Yale, so Deborah Ramirez. I agree sensitivity is always going to be an issue in how they handle this, but I think on the whole, I think the media has been a positive in this affair for the most part.
Yesterday, we saw Orrin Hatch waving off protesters demanding to speak with him by saying, quote, grow up. I mean, a lot of people feel that so much is at stake that if they need to get into an elevator and talk to someone and tell their story, then that's what they need to do.
Well, that's one of the fascinating things about this. I mean, it cuts both ways, because what I've been reading a lot the last couple of days, and you've probably seen this as well, is that people are saying that conservatives, you know, and the Republican Party and the right wing is energized by the vehemence with which people on the left are protesting Kavanaugh. You know, in other words, when people confront senators in an elevator, when people sometimes go to their homes, I think there were some people who had a quote keg party unquote outside Mitch McConnell's house last night. And you know, I mean, these are tactics. You can debate all of them. Certainly, I think the reaction has been very mixed, but maybe mixed to negative about protesters who confront politicians when they try and eat dinner in a restaurant, right? I mean, that's been one of the most loaded things. And so there's some, I mean, there's an interesting debate, and I honestly don't know the answer to this, of whether this is energizing the Republican base, that this is what they use, this is the kind of thing that they use to get their voters worked up.
Well, and that's also a good tactic to take away coverage of what actually a Kavanaugh confirmation would mean for people. You know, whether it's women, men, workers, the environment. I mean, the list is so long. This is massive changes will happen if Kavanaugh is confirmed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you guys covered any of the floor speeches today before the closure vote, but the first speaker was Chuck Grassley, the Senate Judiciary Chairman. And, I mean, his whole speech was centered around basically the protest, and that now we're seeing, quote, mob rule, unquote, was the word he used to describe the Democrats. And you're absolutely right. You know, this is being used as a tool to take away the debate. The other thing I would say, you know, I mean, the flip side of when you talk about people confronting senators in their elevators, that's because we have a government that's not accountable to everyday people. We have politicians who are bought and paid for by large corporations, you know, and lobbyists who have unlimited access to these politicians at parties and fundraisers. And the average person, you know, a 23-year-old working class woman who's been sexually assaulted and has a story to tell, you know, what access does she have to a U.S. senator? And then she sees one in an elevator. I mean, I think it's great, personally. I mean, I think people need to, you know, confront our politicians more often, not less often, because they live in such a shielded world, and they shouldn't. They should be accessible to all the people. But, you know, so few of them have town hall meetings or other types of events anymore where the average public citizen can interact with them. So, yeah, people going up in the elevators. I think it's great.
So let's talk, Will, because we have about 5 minutes left. The machine behind Kavanaugh. What do you think of the coverage of this? I mean, this morning NPR had on someone from the Judicial Crisis Network, but didn't really give listeners any background of who this group is, who their funders are, what their interests are. We did a show last week about the Federalist Society, the Judicial Crisis Network, the religious right that are all pushing Kavanaugh, spending millions and millions of dollars on ads to get him elected, and at the end of the day, why they want him elected. And The Intercept has a piece called by Li Fong, Corporate Front Groups Lobby to Confirm Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. He could give them vastly expanded power. And he reports that business groups with interest before the court have orchestrated a multifaceted campaign to pressure the Senate to swiftly confirm Kavanaugh. What do you think about coverage of this angle?
I don't think it's covered enough. I mean, we were talking just a minute ago about Anna Marie Tarillo, the activist who confronted Jeff Flake, who happens to work for a liberal advocacy group. And, you know, the Republicans have made such a big deal about this, and now in the last day or two, they're trying to say that, you know, George Soros is paying for the liberal opposition. It's just an absurd allegation when, as you described, I mean the amount of money and just the strength of these advocacy networks. And I don't know if you mentioned the Federal Society, but I mean basically the right wing has had this group, for years that works with these other corporate groups that's determined to get a right wing judiciary in this country. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the story behind the story. And yet, because either we've come to accept it or just like you said, there's just such little coverage of it, the right can make these ridiculous allegations about liberals doing the same thing when liberals are doing about 1/20th of what conservatives do. So to your basic point, I mean, I think you're right. I think obviously public awareness of this is not as high as it should. And, you know, I think one thing that's been perhaps maybe a little bit disappointing about the way the Kavanaugh thing played out is, if it hadn't been for the Dr. Ford's allegations, I guess he would have been confirmed by now. But, in the last week, the focus has become kind of just that when, from day one, I think there should have been a very strong focus on, his position on corporate power and because that's really the most important thing the court takes up. So, Yeah, I mean, bottom line, I mean, I know it's a column, I've tried to write about this issue several times, but it is disappointing that, people don't put what's happening with our judiciary in the bigger context.
Right. Well, and just to give some numbers, Li Fang reports that most major corporations and wealthy donors are using 501c nonprofit groups that do not require transparency to air upward of $15 million in advertising spending to convince the public to support Kavanaugh. Other conservative groups contributing to the ad war have not disclosed how much they're spending. You've got groups like the Chamber of Commerce, the Koch brothers funded Americans for Prosperity, various political groups like the Republican Attorneys General Association, also spearheading campaigns, and a number of lobbying groups eager to elevate Kavanaugh to rule on really important cases that will affect their businesses.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Judicial Crisis Network specifically has never revealed what their main funding sources are. It's never been forced to reveal that, and it's not public information. And, you know, if anybody watches cable TV, their ads are on constantly, you know, ads with, you know, women praising Kavanaugh and the tagline, it didn't happen, which is, I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, nothing like this has really ever happened in American history. I mean, if you go back 30 years, if you can imagine if they had used these tactics during the confirmation fight over Robert Bork, Bork might have been on the Supreme Court. He might have been there instead of Anthony Kennedy, and he would have had an even more radical right Supreme Court these last 30 years than what we ended up having. So, you know, it really is an alarming moment in American history. Try though we may, it seems hard to really put the enormity of this in perspective.
Well, final thoughts, Will, again, just on the activism. I mean, women from all over the country and men have gone to D.C. to pressure their senators to vote against Kavanaugh and airing their sexual assault stories for the very first time.
I think it's a turning point in American history. And I think the other thing is, I think in a lot of communities, you see certain types of voters mobilized who were never mobilized before. And I think you're going to see the fallout in November, not just in the congressional elections, but I think in other elections that are just as important, like state legislatures. There are a lot of Republicans representing some of these affluent suburban districts where you tend to find the most anger over Trump, and now you're seeing a lot of anger over Kavanaugh. I mean, there are a lot of women voters, but especially it seems like more affluent ones who are just deserting the Republican Party in droves. So, I think the loud voices of October are going to lead to the many votes of November.
Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist, national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and author of the political blog Attitude. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Rose. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, we'll get an announcement from Susan Collins in just about an hour, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to David LaTulipe for running today's board. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.